Welcome to the Bible class of Jews for Jesus with Bob Mendelson.
Ecclesiastes chapter 7. I like the play on words that happens here right in verse 1. It says, Tov shem mishemen. A good name is better than good ointment. That's what it is. It's a play on words. Shem and shemen, a name, and the oil is not the first and it won't be the last in the text. The word better is used a lot in the whole book. And I don't remember how many times in chapter 7 alone. But in chapter 7 and chapter 8, which we're going to run into tonight, we're going to talk about life continuing in its unfulfilling nature. That is wrong life. And we're going to focus on wisdom, which is spoken of 14 times in these two chapters alone. So a good name is better than good ointment. And the day of one's death is better than the day of one's birth. Yipes. Does that sound like a hopeful person or what? How does it make sense? When will they respect you? When you're dead. Because then it won't change. So today, you've got a good name, let's say. But maybe you go off the rails and you start doing wrong things. For instance, look at the news and the amount of celebrities and politicians and sports people whom we used to admire. And then we find out the dirt. And their name has gone down. So you're right, exactly what Solomon is meaning here. A good name is fixed when it's dead. So they don't have unveilings like we have with John Kennedy today, 50 years after he's dead. Yeah, a lot of stories about him. A good name, it's perpetual. It's not only while you're alive. This is exactly what Solomon is meaning. And that's why he says it's better to go to a house of mourning than to go to a house of feasting, because that's the end of every man. And the living takes it el libo, to his heart. Sorrow's better than laughter. So you get this picture of wisdom, which we're going to comment on a lot here, that it's going to make your life better. Your life is going to be better if you've got wisdom. Now, I think Solomon, he's dealing with himself a lot as he unpacks this. And he knows his name used to be good, and it's deteriorated. There's an erosion of his good name. And so he's telling the world, he might be telling his son, he might be telling his congregation, he might be telling whoever's listening, you know, it's better if you don't have a whole lot. It's better when you run into the sanctuary that you're quiet. It's better that you don't grab for everything, because you can get it all and you've got nothing. All those trivial pursuits that we saw in the second chapter are warnings to us all. So he says the best thing you can ever get is a good name. And it's better than a longer name. If you want to play with the word shemen as longer than the word shem, a name, it's just better than anything else that you might gain. Good oil was good value. Good oil was good monetary gain, good money, and good pleasure, and good comfort and relief. A good name is better than all that. All right. In fact, he's saying here that things that look sorrowful, look at verse 3, is better than laughter. That's probably the theme of the first few verses. When a face is sad, a heart may be happy. The mind of the wise is in the house of mourning, while the mind of fools is in the house of pleasure. So if you want to be wise, hang out with people who aren't jumping up and down. Last Saturday night, I went to a party of some friends who were celebrating the opening of their business. Okay? And I took some photos, as I do, and they were very happy about that. And while I was there, I watched them slowly erode from civility to silliness to drunken stupor. And they were having a good time. At the end, I just said, you know, I've really got to go. I think these people are treasures. I really love them and would do anything to help them. But my goodness, I watched them in the house of feasting. And they ate and drank and drank and ate and drank, and you couldn't find a real conversation among them. Whereas in the house of mourning, you sit, you talk, you commune, you're compassionate, Rachmanis rises, and reality happens. So I think that's what he's saying. Sorrow is greater. What does he say? Verse 3. Sorrow is better than laughter. In the Psalms, we read the Psalm of Moses. You know, Moses wrote one psalm. Verse 11 of Psalm 90 says, "Who understands the power of your anger and your fury according to the fear that is due you? So, teach us to number our days, that we may present to you a heart of wisdom." Verse 10 of Psalm 90 is, "For the days of our life," what are they? 70 and 10. "If by reason of strength or vigor, then 80 or 80 years. He says, "As for the days of our life, they contain 70, or if due to strength, 80 years. Yet their pride is but labor and sorrow, for soon it's gone and we fly away. Who understands the power of your anger and your fury? So teach us to number our days, that we might present to you a heart of wisdom." What's he saying?
Make every moment count.
You know, you're going to die one day. So not live for today in a celebrating like they did Saturday night, but live for today to serve people. Live for today to make the best of the time you've got. It's a gift. To everything there's a season, and a time for every purpose under heaven. A time to die, a time to rejoice, a time to mourn, a time for all these things. So make the best use of your time today. And you get that in the house of mourning over against the house of laughter and festivity. You get the reality of life rather than the dispensing with life. In frivolity, you get gaiety, you get pleasure, but you don't get substance all the time. So Solomon is telling us that he's gotten it wrong, and he doesn't want us to get it wrong. What does the apostle say in the book of Hebrews? Moses chose the rejection, the hostility, the displeasure in Egypt rather than the passing pleasure of sin. What a great phrase that is about going with the flow and going to the party in Egypt's palace. He chose the passing pleasure of sin to line up with the people of God instead of with those who were bawdy. And by the way, the word pleasure there is simcha, but it's a warning. Verse 5 and 6, he does another tov. It's another something better. Of course, it's good. The word is good. Sorrow is good than laughter in verse 3, but we use the more good, meaning better. Verse 5, it's better to listen to the rebuke of a wise man than for one to listen to the song of fools. For as the crackling of thorn bushes under a pot, so is the laughter of the fool. And this too is hevel. Havel. Look at verse 6. And you will hear these words, and maybe that'll help you. Ki kakol hasirim tachat hasir. As the crackling of the bushes of thorns under a seer, under a pot, so is the laughter of the fool. And look at the last couple words of verse 5. Shir kisilim. So there may be a play on the word shir, seer, and sirim. It's not the same letters, seer and sirim. Those are the same letters. Shir is the shin and seer is the samach. Mm-hmm. But it may be in his poetry, he was grabbing at that. So it's better to listen to the rebuke of a wise man. How in the world is that? That rebuke is better than living without rebuke. This is another nature of wisdom. This is a part of wisdom. That our life is improved if we are rebuked, corrected, challenged. As the crackling of thorn bushes under a pot, so is the laughter of the fool. What's under a pot? Fire. That's what it is. So he says, it's crackly, it does stuff, but it doesn't have substance. What does it end up being?
Soot.
Soot and ashes. Yeah. So it might be lively and sparkly and fun. I like the word crackling. But it doesn't last. So again, the passing pleasure of sin. Wisdom is longer lasting than that. We're going to see that a couple more times here. So rebuke is better. But look at verse 5. I like this. Tov lishmoa. It's better to listen to the rebuke of a wise man. So in other words, it's not just that you heard a rebuke. And sorry, not that a guy rebuked you, but that you heard it. Sometimes we get corrected. We're in our congregation, we're listening to a sermon, or we're listening online. I don't know if you do that. People online are listening online, so that's good. I don't know who else they listen to. I hope they listen to a lot of different people. And they're corrected. Sometimes they hear a thing, oh, yeah, my buddy called me up and said, look, I'm a little nervous about you're going to parties on Saturday night. with people who are crackling pots. You know, I'm a little nervous about that. And so he says, I think you need to stay home next Saturday night. I'm feeling something in my spirit for you, right? So if you hear that, you're good to go, good to not go. Say, you're good. You're hearing the rebuke of your brother. That's a good thing when God's people warn each other about going off the rails. And that's better than the sheer, better than the song of the fool, because that is just noise under the pot. It's just laughter. It's not going to work. So it's not just that you are rebuked, it's that you listen to it. All right, third thing, verses 7 through 9. Oppression makes a wise man halal, mad, and a bribe makes his heart avad, it corrupts it. So the end and the beginning, patience, don't be eager, anger. So what's he saying? It's not a matter of what you're doing today, it's how you're going to finish. It's get to the end of the... It's out of his control. He's oppressed. And sometimes it's not just he that's oppressed. He's watching oppression happen to other people. And that makes a wise man upset. And it's righteous indignation, we call it. And a bribe, which this wise man is watching, corrupts the heart. He also corrupts the other people. It doesn't corrupt a wise man unless he takes it on board. So Solomon, again, reflecting his own failures, is saying, I used to be a wise man, now I am corrupted. And my corruption is from bribes. So money got me stumbled. And we talked about wealth and riches last week, giving us the uncertainty of an unfulfilling life. Now we're looking at nothing helping us and all this sin that's abundant. But wisdom is going to help us. And I've put down, marathons are greater than shortcuts. Unless the Lord stopped it, even the very chosen, even the elect, would not make it. In Matthew 24, Yeshua is talking about the last of days. And he said, he that endures to the end shall be saved. I think that's probably in Solomon's mind, or Yeshua is reflecting this commentary, that it's not how Solomon started, it's how Solomon finished. And it's not how you start, it's not how you start, it's how we finish. So one of the things people ask me often when I'm in churches hither and yon, and they say, what can we pray for? I say, well, I want you to pray for X, Y, or Z. You know, right now we're asking prayer for the situation in Israel, in Beersheba. We're asking for prayers for David Brickner, who's the leader of Jews for Jesus, to make wise decisions about who's going where, because there's some deployment happening. And we're asking God for a lot of things. But I always ask people, and one more thing, please pray for me to make it to the end. I want to be there at the end saying glory to God. I want to say Yeshua is my Savior at the last breath. And many of the songs, I don't know if you listen to old hymns. And even in modern hymnody, there are some guys who write good hymns. Most people today just write a song with a verse and a chorus. And it's not the same as a substantial hymn of the past. And what they used to do, the first two verses would be about something that the hymn writer is reflecting. The third verse would always get to it. It would have to get to the cross. You have to nail the cross. And then the fourth verse was always about heaven, always about the end of things. And just think back on hymns that you remember, like Amazing Grace. And the fourth verse, when we've been there 10,000 years, bright shining as the sun. Or, it is well with my soul. But guys today have written some too, like, at my last breath, I want to be singing his praise. I like those kinds of things where it gets me to the end of my life, and I want to be singing those songs. I wrote my own funeral, and I put a couple of those songs in there so that at the last I was making sure that I was doing that. That's not morbid. Better the end of my life than the beginning of my life. All right. The end of a matter is better than its beginning, verse 8. Tov acharit davar mereshito. That's it. Yeah, it's better the beginning or the final of a thing than its beginning. And that's what he's saying. Let's finish well. The marathon is better than taking any shortcuts. In fact, I saw a TV show or a movie. It was so funny. Some guy hopped into a marathon towards the end. he'd run, he'd started and he ran, and he got off the trail and had a sandwich or a Coca-Cola or so, I don't know what it was, and then drove around and got to the end and came running around the final turn, and almost, I think, was successful. He didn't win, but I mean, he almost was, feeling good. You know? You think, what is that about? In modern days, can you imagine it? How do you like these guys in sport today who complain to the referees when there are 9 cameras trained on every person? Like, I never did it. Of course you did. Here are 9 evidences of that. You know? They didn't have such things in those days, but the marathon is greater than the shortcut. And then verse 10, do not say, why is it that the former days were better than these? For it is not from wisdom that you ask about this. So what are we saying? Today is better than yesterday. Death is better than birth. We're saying the end of the matter matters more than the beginning of the matter. And that is when wisdom makes your life better. There are some really positive results to wisdom. Let's look at those in verses 11 and following, 11 through 14. Wisdom is protection. Wisdom is good. Wisdom, wisdom, wisdom. He is pinging this bell, so we shouldn't miss it. It's better than so many other things. It's better than being a fool. I mean, that's obvious.
But earlier on he said, whether you're stupid or smart, it makes no difference. You're going to die anyway.
Well, he's talking about something else in those earlier wisdom questions. And he does that in Proverbs, and he does that in Song of Songs. His comparisons are righteous, so he's hitting a different angle on wisdom today. Your life is going to be better if you live a life of wisdom. I didn't do that. Therefore, listen to me now. Better that I rebuke you and you listen to me. But it's not going to prevent you from dying. That's what he said earlier. And we're going to hit another wisdom passage in 10 and 12. We're not done with this idea. It's one of the wisdom books. That's why it's in the wisdom literature. Verse 11, wisdom along with an inheritance is good, and there's that word advantage. We've seen it over and over, yoter, to those who see the sun. Wisdom is better, though, than wealth, isn't it?
Yes.
Wisdom is protection. The Hebrew is tsel, meaning shadow. And one of my favorite words in the Bible, in the shadow of your wings. And tselem is often used the image, b'tselmenu, God created us in our image. Tsel and tselem are cousins, I think. And I see the shadow of God and the defense, it's often translated over and over again. But it's this nature of, you see it, today's getting a little chilly outside, but earlier I was in the sun and it was beating down on me and I was seriously hot just for a moment. Yeah, I don't know what that was. Well, it was the steaminess. I think the humidity was severe. And I was in the sun and the first thing I wanted to do was get in the shade and get protected from that sun. It's 93 million miles away. You think, what would a little leaf do? But a little leaf does a lot of good for us. And he's saying, that's the tsel. That's this shadowy protection that's over you. Wisdom is that, just as money is as well. But the advantage of knowledge is that wisdom preserves the lives of its possessors. If you're smart, if you're wise, if you've got chokhmah, then you're better off than if you've just got money. Money protects you, to be sure. You got money, you got a credit card, I guess. You got a credit card, you can do okay for a month, 2 months. You know, if you've got money, or in this, it's kesef, it's the Hebrew. If you've got silver, if you've got coins, if you've got stuff by the which you buy things, you've got a sense of protection. There's a Jewish girl who just moved over here to Jewish House. She lost her place out in Parramatta. I've known her for years, and I feel so bad for her. And I want to shout her an apartment, but I'll only do it for a month. But then what happens next month or the month after that? Money's a protection for those who have it, and she has no protection, and I feel so bad for her. If you have it, it's good, but it's not as good as having wisdom. Wisdom is the best protection from the heat of every striking sun and every striking wind that's going to come against you. So wisdom is better than all the money you can ever accrue and all your credit cards. Verse 13, consider the work of God who is able to straighten what he has bent. What he's saying here is, think about what God did, that if you really get it, what God did is nothing you can override. So in a way, it's God's design. What Oswald Chambers calls being an amateur providence, where you go in and fix what God obviously needs your help to fix. Oswald is saying, that's not going to work. Solomon is saying the same thing. That's not going to work. If God has set something in the heavens, if he set something in the earth, don't try to muck it up. Don't try to fix it. If, for instance, somebody who used to walk with God is walking away from God, and he starts to have more troubles and more troubles, don't fix the troubles, because those troubles might be God's plan and God's design to get him back to his senses. Imagine the prodigal son, the lost son. Let's just look at it for a minute. I like this text. Luke chapter 15 is the story of some lost things giving pleasure when they're found. Luke chapter 15, look at this, in verse number 11, after he's told stories about a woman who found some coin that she lost overnight, and a fella who was a shepherd who lost one of the sheep, he went out and found the lost sheep. In verse 11, he says, "A man had two sons. The younger of them said to his father, 'Father, give me the share of the estate that falls to me.' So he," the father, "divided his," the father's, "wealth between them. And not many days later, the younger son gathered everything together and went on a journey into a distant country, and he squandered his estate with loose living." Oh, there's nothing like that word, squander. "And when he had spent everything, a severe famine occurred in that country, and he began to be impoverished. So he went and hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country, and he," the citizen, "sent him," the son, "into the fields to feed swine. And he would have gladly filled his stomach with the pods that the swine were eating, and no one was giving anything to him. And then when," verse 17, "but when he came to his senses, he said, 'How many of my father's hired men have more than enough bread, but I'm dying here with hunger? I'm going to get up, I'm going to go to my father and say to him, Father, I've sinned against heaven and in your sight.'" Now let's say you lived around that hired man's, the citizen's home. Let's say you lived near that pig farm, and you saw this fellow who came, who looked desperate, a desperado, and you said, "Oh, I should help that guy. I really need to help that guy. Look at him. He doesn't even have the food that the pigs are eating. Oh, I feel so bad for him. I better give him some food. I'm going to invite him to lunch. I'm going to take care of him. I'm going to build him a little house. I'm going to invite him to my apartment. I'm going to take care of him." If you do that, according to this story, you're going to become what Oswald Chambers calls an amateur providence, doing what God does instead of letting God do what God does. That's what Solomon is saying in Ecclesiastes. Let God be God. Don't you mess it up. Unless the Lord builds the house, they who labor, labor in vain. That's spot on. That's exactly the same idea. Unless God's in it, unless God's doing it, unless God's leading you, you're going to mess things up even worse than that guy, the hireling, has messed things up. And that prodigal son has messed up pretty badly. But God has a plan to take him to the lowest possible place so he can come to his senses. So back to Ecclesiastes. Be careful of fixing things. Don't let your compassion outdo the compassion of God. So that's verse 13. Let God's design be God's work. And don't you design better than God. I often say my prayer something like, "God, you know that situation, you know those people, you know the mess that that is. I don't need to tell you how to fix it. I just want to say, when you do, remind me and I'll give you thanks." Verse 14, "In the day of prosperity, be happy, but in the day of adversity, consider. God has made the one as well as the other so that man will not discover anything that will be after him, including the troubles in which we find ourselves." Wisdom lets us see life a lot clearer. We can see things better than money. We can see things better than fixing everything. And we can see God better than the troubles that surround us. I've seen everything during my lifetime. It's really just my days of futility. There's a righteous man who perishes in his righteousness, and there's a wicked man who prolongs his life in his wickedness. Not fair, we cry. Don't be excessively righteous and don't be overly wise. Why should you ruin yourself? Don't be excessively wicked and don't be a fool. Why should you die before your time? It's good, meaning it's better, that you grasp one thing and also not let go of the other. For the one who fears God comes forth with both of them. Don't go nuts trying to be an ascetic and live an impoverished life. And don't try to grab for all the money you can. Don't try to be smarter than everybody, and don't try to be stupider than everybody. Just carry on. You know you're going to die. Why are you going to ruin yourself on your way there? Just take what's there on board. Walk with God. Fear God. That's his answer in verse 18. The one who fears God comes forth with both of them. So you're going to be all right. You're going to have all of them, in fact, the Hebrew is. All of them. So wisdom, verse 19, strengthens a wise man more than 10 rulers who are in a city. There's not a righteous, verse 20 is one I quote all the time with Jewish people. Because what's the number one thing that Christians are always saying to people about sin? That everybody does it. And in fact, everybody, including you, do it. I mean, it's not just, okay, there's this blanket on the world of sin. But they indict everybody. Christians say that everybody sins. And Jewish people respond with, no, 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 we have Yetzer Hara, we have Yetzer Tov. And this idea of sin is so uncomfortable for us Jewish people. Until when? Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. And then we say, yeah, we sin a little, but we're not that bad. Or I don't even believe in sin, or whatever we get to. But the point is that Ecclesiastes 7:20 says there's not a righteous man on earth who continually does good and doesn't sin. There is no one. The Psalm said the same thing. The Psalm says there's no, not one who's a righteous man. That you say, wait a minute, what about the tzaddik in town? Well, what does it say? In other words, which is more accurate? Sure, of course there are people who are more righteous or apparently more righteous, holier people. But the reality is we all sin. And so Christians actually have that right. They got it right. And sometimes we didn't get it right. There's not a righteous man on earth who continually does good and who never sins. If you memorize that verse, that's a goodie. Asher yaseh tov velo yecheta. There's not one who is always doing good and doesn't sin. Also, don't take seriously all words which are spoken so that you will not hear your servant cursing you. For you also have realized that you likewise have many times cursed others. We blow it. And I guess wisdom gives us a strength or an ability. It gives us an ability to take all the rest of life on. I'm not going to be fussed. I'm not going to be stressed about there's cancer in the world and everybody around me is catching cancer. Or back in the 80s and 90s, everybody around me is catching AIDS. Or in the 2000s, everybody around me is catching SARS or the bird flu. I don't know what to do. I'm going to die. There's a way to handle situations that wisdom allows. And I'm not saying don't deal with things in a proper fashion, but don't stress, because you're not going to be able to change one hair of your head. You're not going to be able to extend your life or shorten it. That's what he's saying here. Wisdom gives us an ability to face everything about life. Verse 20, our own sins. Verse 21 and 22, what are they cursing? You know, they're cursing us. So our own reputation. We can handle our lack of reputation or our reputation. It doesn't matter what people say. If they praise you, don't believe it. And if they curse you, don't believe it. Because wisdom allows you to disregard it. I may have told some of you this because it's one of my favorite moments in Broadway. It was in the Broadway show Amadeus, which they then made into the movie. Beautiful movie. I should sell it. No. It's a great play. And an even better Broadway show. And in the show, you might know the story. Salieri is the court musician. He's the one whom the king had said, you will be my court musician. And he, as the court musician, got to see everybody who came through who were musos. And up comes this upstart, Wolfgang Amadeus, loved by God, Mozart. And immediately Salieri sees Mozart's gift. He says, this guy has the gift. And in the show, Salieri hates him and purposes to kill him so that Salieri can maintain his realm and his prestige and his position. Because if it went on the basis of giftedness, Salieri said, I can't even do a simple tune. And Mozart can take a simple tune and make a symphony out of it. I mean, he was brilliant. So in the show, Salieri, it was so well choreographed, is standing there and some people are applauding him. And across the stage walks Mozart. And Salieri said this line, how terrible to be distinguished by those who cannot distinguish at all. Wow. That's a knife to your own gut, isn't it? To know your reputation is praised and worthless. These people who are praising me don't know music at all. I know music and I know I don't have the gift. That's what he's saying. So it's the same thing Solomon is saying here. Don't take seriously, verse 21, all the words which are spoken so that you won't hear your servant cursing you, because you've probably cursed other people too. Don't worry about your reputation. It's irrelevant.
Well, then how does that work with Deuteronomy 30? Then if there is power in the tongue and every word is binding. I understand. It's kind of like, don't get really super sensitive.
Don't get sensitive, not even super sensitive. Don't even care what people say. Who cares what they say?
But it's binding.
No, it's not binding. The proverb says, like a sparrow in its flitting, so does a curse without warrant not alight. Like a sparrow in its flitting. A curse that's not true, it's not going to touch me. I don't care what people say. I don't care if that guy across the street curses me. That has no bearing on my life. I'm under a blessing. I'm not under a curse. And he can say whatever he wants to say. He can do voodoo. He can incant anything. But it's not going to touch me. Like a sparrow in its flitting. Don't misread Deuteronomy 30.
Likewise, it's not what people think of.
It's what God thinks of you. Wisdom allows us to disregard the words of others. Because if they praise you, it's irrelevant. If they curse you, it's irrelevant. Verse 21, 22, our own reputation. 23 to 25, I tested all this with wisdom. I said, I'll be wise, but it was far from me. What has been is remote and exceedingly mysterious. Who can discover it? I directed my mind to know, to investigate, to seek wisdom and an explanation, and to know the evil of folly and the foolishness of madness. And I discovered more bitter than death, the woman whose heart is snares and nets, whose hands are chains. One who's pleasing to God will escape from her, but the sinner will be captured by her. Our own cluelessness. I wasn't even sure what was, and wisdom will override my own cluelessness. I mean, that makes sense, obviously. Get a clue, some people would say today. In other words, think outside your little box because you don't get it. So get some wisdom. And biblically, wisdom is seeing things from God's point of view. That's my definition. It's probably others as well. Wisdom is seeing things from God's point of view. And if you do that, then all your own cluelessness that I find here in verse 23 to 25 to 26 is overridden. Look at verse 26 to 29. And I discovered more bitter than death the woman whose heart is snares and nets. If I would have just pleased God, I would have escaped from her. Behold, I have discovered this, says the Kohelet, adding one thing to another to find an explanation, which I am still seeking but have not found. I have found one man among 1,000, but I have not found a woman among all these. You'll forgive him. Behold, I have found only this, that God made man upright, but they have sought out many devices. I'm not helped. It reminds me of Isaiah, who says in chapter 6, when he sees God, Ram Vanisa, high and lifted up, and he says, I am in trouble because I am a man of unclean lips. And what does he say next? No, but that's true. He says that earlier. Woe is me, for I am undone. I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell among a people of unclean lips. So that's what I think Solomon is reflecting here. He says, I'm bad, I was clueless, and the guys around me were just as clueless. So wisdom will give me a capacity to see my own cluelessness and strengthen me and make my life better. And even though I have no one around me, maybe that will help me to sort out who they are or who they aren't. wisdom carries on into chapter 8. It's not excessively long. It's just 17 verses, but I'll cover it in just a moment. Who is like the wise man and who knows the interpretation of a matter? A man's wisdom gives him light, illumines him, and causes his stern face to beam. Isn't that great? Who's like the wise man and who knows the interpretation? It's not a desperate thing. He says there's a lot of wisdom that's still out there if we'll listen to the right source, if we'll get the right learning. I don't know how many people I meet on the telephone here in letters. We get letters pretty regularly from people who are telling me, well, I used to be at this church, and then I moved to that church, and then I moved to this church, and then I moved to that church. And I look at these people like shoppers who used to go to Williams and Sonoma, and then they went to David Jones, then they went to Meyer, and then they found the little boutique shop. I don't know what they are, but they are not going to gain wisdom. They're going to have a lot of knowledge, but they're not going to have a lot of wisdom. He says, basically, you want wisdom, you got to have authority. And it's the wise man who has authority. Now, he used to be that wise man, so he knows his own erosion, and he knows that he didn't maintain it. He's expressing the problem of evil continuing here. Verse 2, I say, keep the command of the king because of the oath before God. Don't be in a hurry to leave him. Don't be in a hurry to leave the king. If you're in a good congregation, stay there. What makes a congregation good is not only that the preacher preaches or the singer sings or the announcements are on video, but that you have a place where you can serve. I loved it that you guys came last night and pitched in. Just did stuff. Whatever you can do to help. I just think that's great. You do it here and you do it wherever you go. Just keep doing that, because church or congregation or community is not about what people do for you. It's what you do for the world. It's about making the world a better place. Wisdom separates out me orientation to them orientation. If you get that, you're way ahead of the game. You're way ahead of the pack out there. Yeah, we're going to unpack this a lot next week, chapters 8 and 9. So maybe I'll just leave it there for tonight.
You've been listening to the Bible class of Jews for Jesus in Australia. For more information, contact Jews for Jesus, Post Office Box 925, Sydney, Australia 2001. God bless you.